Welcome to Urban Prepping, Episode 4. Urban Prepping is the podcast dedicated to helping us live a more prepared and self-sufficient lifestyle in the urban context. Again, thank you for tuning in and listening today. My name is Greg, and I am your host. And as always, I would love it if you could get back to me with feedback on the podcast or a review in iTunes. I'd love to hear what you think of what I'm doing here. Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? You like what I have to offer? It's a waste of your time. Some feedback on what you would find more helpful or useful. Maybe subjects or topics that I can talk about. You can reach me at loneurbanprepper@gmail.com. And also iTunes reviews. They help me help the podcast get found on iTunes. And again, I don't care if the reviews are good, bad, or ugly. Just again, really interested into hearing feedback on how I can make this a more useful and interesting podcast. We all, you know, have a lot of demands on our time, and I know that there's a lot of information out there. I think podcasting, or this podcast that covers things from more of an urban context, is perhaps an area that isn't being covered as much in some of the others. So I hope you enjoy it. Today we're going to talk about security, specifically home security. The security is a pretty broad topic. There's sort of being, you know, how do you keep yourself and your family secure when you're moving about on the street, public events, things like that. But, you know, we're just sort of ramping up in this podcast, covering some sort of the areas that we all think about, trying to cover things in order of importance or priority, if you will. And security may not be number four in that list, but it's pretty far up there. And it's a topic that a lot of people, I think, either like to talk about or do talk about. So I thought I would jump in on it. So we're going to talk about security today, specifically home security. And, you know, again, I always want to start off sort of in my philosophy of use or my philosophy of prepping. And as I talked about quite a bit in the last podcast, and I won't talk about too much today, and that's, I don't believe that the world is going to end. I don't believe that there's going to be this Teotihuacan event. I do think that the economy could collapse. I do think that, you know, there could be some very large natural disasters that could really, really change sort of the face of how things are for weeks, maybe months in certain part of the country. But I don't believe that it'll become this post-apocalyptic, you know, postman / road warrior existence. I just don't believe that's going to happen. So my philosophy is, or my prepping approach is really based on a slightly different reality. Certainly one where crime could go up, where things could get very hard, food shortages due to delivery problems because roads are out, rampant runaway inflation, massive unemployment, you know, situations where people are broke, where their money isn't worth nearly as much as it used to, they're out of work, trouble getting access to food, and we all know that those types of things can often lead to crime and bad behavior. We've seen a lot of situations. So that's the backdrop around which I'd like to sort of think about this. You know, for me, I wouldn't say it's a turning point, but something that sort of helped solidify where I was, how I was thinking about prepping, and I mentioned in my last podcast, is the book, the Surviving the Economic Collapse by Fernando Aguirre, I believe his last name is pronounced. And it's a real-life account of the economic meltdown in Argentina around 2001. Now, the U.S. isn't Argentina, but there are more similarities than you might realize, and he makes a really compelling case for what an economic meltdown here might look like. I ended up reading the entire book in one evening. I skimmed some parts of it because they covered areas that I felt, you know, his point of view wasn't necessarily giving me a ton of new information, and I was really interested to get to some of the topics that he could definitely give me sort of new information. But it's a good book. I really liked it. I really, really liked it. And what I liked most about it is it's based in reality, man. This actually happened. This guy actually lived through it. And I think in some ways it confirms some of our concern. It confirms some of the things that we worry about. But it also helps us take a perhaps a more realistic look at how things might be. You know, I may be wrong. I may be betting a lot on the wrong horse. But it's kind of how I'm looking at things. You know, according to Fair Foul, Argentina was not without rule of law, but the police were unpaid, or at least underpaid and understaffed. So things were tough, man, especially in the countryside, which is really interesting. You know, a lot of us think about, you know, bugging out, getting to that remote location. And as an urban population, as people who live in cities, maybe even apartments, we think about being, you know, at a huge disadvantage in our preparedness in that situation. But, you know, that may not be the case. In Argentina, you know, the inner cities were actually much safer because that's where the police focused. Now, this may not hold true for the U.S., but, you know, our suburbs tend to be safer and more tame than the urban areas than a lot of cities. And I think given a meltdown, you will see those areas continue to be policed and taken care of. But, you know, if you're mayor of a big city and you can't show that your city center, that the area that is most associated with commerce and business is safe, if you can't show that, you're in deep trouble. And we all know that politicians' number one concern is holding on to their own job security. So while your suburb police department, your suburb sort of emergency services may be very focused on your area, I think that in most cities, you're going to see probably just the, you know, a police sort of almost being militant in trying to control trouble, which in some ways might be pretty good. You know, you sort of stamp out bad behavior, but it also means probably some bit of tyranny and probably loss of freedoms. You know, we've all heard the stories about how police went door to door in New Orleans after Katrina and just started confiscating weapons. And I don't think most of them were ever returned. So the point is that you know, the breakdown or after something awful happens, I think the police will be there. The question is, how well are they able to cover an area, and what, you know, how are they going to be either helping or contributing to the problem? I think to some degree, sort of tyrannical behavior, sort of overzealous militant police behavior could make the problem worse, create flashpoints, create situations where people are more likely to riot and rally against the authorities because they think they're being sort of tramped down too hard. So that's the kind of world that I'm thinking about when I think about preparedness, you know, not a complete breakdown, not Tiatwaki. So let's get into this. As always, I think about security in layers. You know, I think about starting in, you know, in the innermost layer, your home, and then radiating outwards as layers of security or zones of security. And let's start with a home because that's your last line of defense. And ultimately, you know, that's really what's going to kick you into action when you hear someone banging on your door in the middle of the night. Now, I've already covered that I don't think the U.S. is going to descend into, you know, the road warrior. So let's take on another myth. And that, you know, most of us, the vast majority of us, have no prayer of defending our homes against a small group of well-armed invaders who are set on gaining entrance to our houses. Now, let me be really clear. I'm not saying you should not try to defend your house. I'm not saying that someone tries to kick in your door that you have no prayer of defending your house. What I'm talking about is, for instance, in the book by Furfal, he talked about that there was actually reports of what he was calling commando home invasions, you know, like a squad of, what do you want to call them, attackers, descending on a house in sort of a military fashion. There was, I think I remember reading that there was a lot of suspicion that whoever was doing it maybe were ex-military, ex-police, or maybe even current military police. Against something like that, we don't stand much of a chance, and here's why. You know, I know you guys are saying, look, I got a cabinet of guns, I know how to use them, and there's no way someone's going to take my house from me. Well, let's think about this. You know, our houses are not built with materials, for most of them, will stop a rifle round. If you live in a brick house, all right, I think brick will probably stop some, if not all, well, a lot of rifle rounds. But, you know, for how long? I think you can punch holes in brick with it. And I'm not a ballistic expert. But, you know, a lot of houses out there are not built with brick. They're built with wood frame houses with siding on it. And, you know, rifle round 223 will go right through it, and something bigger will go through it and maintain a lot more power. Here's something else. Houses aren't built with defense in mind. You know, houses are designed to let in light, to be open, to ease of access. All of these things are wonderful for quality of life when you're living, not so wonderful if you're trying to defend it. Lots of windows mean lots of things for bullets to come through without anything even slowing them down except a little pane of glass. Lots of points of entry. Someone crawling in a first floor window or throwing a ladder up and crawling in a second story window. Doors, you know, again, great in and out, ease of access, backyard, front yard, basement, garage. But how many different places or how many different ways of means of entry are you going to try to defend? Do you have a squad? Do you have a squad that you can defend your house with? Do you have sons or daughters? Or is your wife, you know, familiar and trained enough with firearms to help you hold down the homestead? Let's say your brother and his two teenage sons, all of which who have tons of military training, moved in with you, and now you can cover the exits, and you can even take turns standing watch. Okay. Now you perhaps have a situation where you do stand a little bit better chance of defending your home. What doesn't change the fact is how easy it is to throw rifle rounds through your house or through windows. But what if someone just decides to burn you out, throw a Molotov cocktail or a gasoline bomb on your roof and let the thing burn down and shoot you as you come flying out? Now, again, in my scenario, in the world that I think is more than likely to happen post a dramatic situation, is there going to be, sustained firefights in the street for someone's house? No, I don't think so. All I'm trying to do is dispel the myth that the vast majority of us can turn our houses into fortresses that we can defend against a group of individuals. Just isn't going to happen. However, that doesn't change my belief on what we should do. Someone tries to kick your door in the middle of the night. Two people try to kick your door in the middle of the night, or during the day, whatever. I just want to sort of start off by saying I recognize the limitations we all have in reality when it comes to defending our house. Okay, so let's take a look again a little bit at sort of what you can, could do, what you should do, what you should not do. Again, this is, you know, talking about an urban context. And I'm not going to go too much into weapons here. This is not going to be a podcast where we talk about, you know, this rifle versus that rifle, or pistol versus rifle, or shotgun versus pistol. I'm more interested in sort of some theory on how you can create layers of safety so perhaps someone even doesn't even get to your front door. They don't even choose your house to do the break-in. That, to me, is far more important than what kind of round I put through someone's head when they do kick my door down. So with that in mind, I mean, you know, let's start with windows. That's the easiest way into a house. First and foremost, I put rods and blocks in all my windows so you can't open them. Even if you'd somehow jimmy the lock, you can't get them open more than an inch or two. That's number one. But, you know, the other thing that people talk about is what you might put in front of your windows or not put in front of your windows to create either barriers or maybe to not put bushes in front of your window because it provides someone some cover behind which to, you know, to spend some time jimmying a window. But, you know, it's interesting because here in the Pacific Northwest, a lot of things that we have growing are things that have thorns and are really tangly and hard to get through. So my approach has been just the opposite. You know, big old thorn or big old rose bush in front of my window, man, that's got some serious thorns that, you know, if you're dedicated and you need to get in, okay, you can get past it, but it certainly isn't going to be an easy option. And, you know, again, to me, most criminals, I think now and any time in the future, they're opportunists. They're looking for the easiest possible target. And I think, you know, just like on the street, the level to which you can to not present an easy target or you help to so your family doesn't present an easy target, your house, you know, you don't want that to be an easy target or look like an easy target. You know, some people, I think, you know, certain situations or certain areas, you know, bars on the window. I personally don't want bars on my windows. I don't want to feel like I live in a prison. But, you know, it's not something that I personally have to, in my situation, worry about. If I was living in an area where it was, you know, and I've lived in places in New York, parts of New York, where I did have window cages and was thankful to have them because it just was one less thing to worry about. Someone climbing in my window while I'm away and taking what little I had because I was living like a cockroach in New York City. You know, but again, it's to me, it's what, you know, if a criminal comes snooping around, looking for an opportunity, windows covered with thorn bushes, tangly stuff that's hard to get through, you know, not a good opportunity. Doors, your doors are next easy point of entry. You need good locks, but your locks are only as good as your door jamb. Something that I'm in the process of doing is I need to upgrade my door security, and I've been looking at this thing called the Door Devil, and I don't know anything about it other than the reviews I've seen online, but the reviews look pretty great. Doesn't look that difficult to install, doesn't appear to be too super expensive, and it does appear to make a big difference in someone's ability to kick your door in. I would love to hear a review from anyone who actually owns one, but that's going to be something that I'm definitely going to be installing shortly. But in the meantime, what I have done is I've improvised. I have my side door and my front door both are in an area where I was able to actually take beams, and at night I can take the beam and jam it into the door on one end and then into a wall on the other side, creating, you know, basically something that makes it impossible for someone to kick the door open because you got this huge beam holding it in place. Now, they might kick the hinges out, they might kick, you know, in case of a side door, may kick through the door, but anyone tries to kick that door open or get it in, I'm going to be out of my bed, weapon in hand, long before they ever get through it. Family to safety, which to me is what it's all about. I would like to stop. I'd like to never have someone choose my home for an invasion. That's number one. Ideally, I'd love it if they didn't walk down my street. If I could keep them from wandering down my street and bothering I or my neighbors, that would be 100%. But if they're going to be on my street, maybe they don't choose my house. If they do choose my house, and I'm in it, I'm going to try to stop them. But most importantly, my focus, once they've chosen my house, my focus is slow them down long enough for me to get my family into our safe spot and myself armed and ready to put rounds in them the minute they walk in my door. And that's, you know, as much as I've talked in the first few minutes of this about, you know, not falling into the myth of sort of some armed firefighter in the street to defend your house against attackers. Someone tries to kick down my door. That's what they have waiting for them. So doors, garage door. You know, I learned a little trick online. I have an automatic garage door opener that broke, and the thing easy to I think that electric garage door openers can be easy to overcome, to jam open a garage door at night. And when I go, I put a huge padlock through the track that the wheels run through. And so keeps the wheels from moving less than an eighth of an inch because I'm able to put a padlock right there above where the wheels are. That door is not going anywhere. So again, slowing people down who are trying to gain access. One last thing that isn't for everyone, and certainly if you live in an apartment or in an urban city, you know, and you're single, you may not have the lifestyle for this, but I think the number one deterrent for anyone choosing your house over some or your apartment over someone else's for a break-in is a dog. I have a great big golden retriever / poodle mix. Yes, it's a poodle mix. And he is the biggest baby on the planet. He is the biggest wimpy dog, family dog, you know, but he barks his face off when anyone comes near the house. And he lunges at the sort of windows we have in the front of the house when the postman or someone else shows up and pretends that he's the fiercest dog on the planet. Now, I think if the door opened and the postman walked in, the dog would probably pee himself, but behind the safety of the windows, or maybe it's because he is afraid, he looks like he is the most ferocious dog on earth when a stranger comes towards the door, at, you know, up our steps, particularly postman, UPS, things like that. So if you're a criminal, if you're someone walking around the neighborhood looking for places to break in, and you got a big, loud dog making noise, and by the way, you see him sort of behave like an attack dog at the window when someone else shows up, you know, pretty good deterrent. The last thing on earth you want to deal with is some loud dog that might attack you the minute you walk in. Layers of security, layers of deterrence. So, and then slowing them down, you know, to give you time to react when they get in. But what's the that next level, right? We've just talked about the house, the inner layer of security. How do we keep people from the front door? How do we keep people from actually choosing your house? You know, the urban context, having an apartment might actually really work in your favor here. Do you have security at, do you live in a building with a doorman or secure front doors? Do you live in an apartment complex that has like walls and gates that you either need a key card to get in, or even the gate's mostly open, but in times necessary, you could close it? Again, layers of deterrent. You know, most apartment complex walls aren't designed to really keep anyone out. It's more about privacy. But in a situation where the crime has gone up, people are more concerned about break-ins, you and your neighbors can certainly keep an eye out for things. And middle of the night, people keeping an eye on things, somebody scaling a wall or during the day, that's a pretty good sign that someone shouldn't be there, right? So, you know, in this case, security, urban context might work in your favor. I mean, you live in an apartment building. What about, you know, your floor? You know, is it, you know, do you have, how much security do you have to just get to your floor of your building? Is it, you know, is your elevator secure? Do you need a key card to get in the elevator? Are the stairwells locked from the outside? Does someone have to climb 6 flights of stairs to get up to your floor? 12 flights of stairs, 24 flights of stairs. All these things could work in your benefit. That also, you know, takes me sort of my last level. You think about sort of not just your neighborhood. You know, how do you work with your neighbors to create a situation where you're looking out for each other? I think, at least in my neighborhood and in most neighborhoods that I've grown up in, you know, people are pretty good about keeping an eye on things. You see somebody that doesn't look familiar, you may not stop and ask them what they're doing, but if you saw them walk up to a house and playing with the door handle or walking around, you might call the police, you might inform neighbors, hey, I saw someone moving around. We have blogs and message boards where people talk about the crime in the area and who's been hit and what, you know, suspects look like, and, you know, it was a dark van that's been seen in the neighborhood. All those things sort of lend to a community helping to look out for each other. You know, in the situation that, that happened in Argentina, you know, maybe you and some of the guys in the neighborhood park some cars at either end of the street. And now you've got, you know, a couple guys at either end of the street that, you know, unless you can prove that you have business on the street or that you live there, you're visiting friends, you know, I'm sorry, you're not even going to walk down the street, or you're not going to drive down the street, because, you know, we're going to try to keep our neighborhood safer. Under most circumstances, police may not look too positive on that. They might sort of run, you know, you might get yourself in a little bit of trouble doing that. But again, depending on the situation, that might also be seen as, you know, people taking their own security situation in hand in a reasonable way and looking out for themselves. And it's one less thing the police have to worry about. The more you can get to know your neighbors, the more you can work with them, the more you can help each other out. Again, provide that layer of security, that level of, you know, maybe instead of your house, you know, now it's, this block isn't worth our time from a criminal perspective. It's not something that I'm willing to get into, because, you know what, it's just, everyone's looking, everyone's paying attention, got lots of dogs. I'm going to move down the line and find another easy target. And that's, you know, I've said this 1,000 times already, but at the end of the day, I think that's a win-win situation. Criminals move on, look for another target, take their game down the street. So lastly, I want to talk a little bit about training. I talked about how we're not going to get into discussion of weapons and what's better and what's worse. But this training topic is a topic that I think is relevant to just about everything we talk about, as it talks about being prepared and self-sufficient. you know, not even, it's not, it doesn't even matter if those bad things don't ever happen. I mean, you know, what's your ability to run up a flight of stairs? How fit are you? You know, can you haul an extra 40 or 50 pounds around for an hour or two? You know, unfortunately, the vast majority of Americans are overweight and out of shape. We live in a country that provides us with a lifestyle that means that a lot of us work behind desks. We stare at a computer all day. We go home. We're tired. We sit on the couch. We don't eat right. And not only does it make us less likely to be fit, but it shortens our lifespan. You know, we create a lot of disease from the way that we eat. You know, diabetes, those sorts of things. So I'm not going to lecture and rant because, you know, I'm not as fit as I should be. But my point is that start now. Start getting fit. Start exercising. You'll feel better. You'll sleep better. You'll have more energy. You'll do more. And most importantly, when push comes to shove, you'll have the ability to do something. You know, most of us, when cornered, don't have trouble taking a swing to defend ourselves. But when's the last time you tried to take, you know, to... When's the last time you were in a fight? When's the last time you went to a gym and hit a heavy bag for 5 minutes? Try that. Try hitting a heavy bag for 5 minutes and throwing punches that you're going to throw to try to end a fight. Yeah. If you haven't done it in a while, I'll be surprised if you last 5 minutes. It's hard. It takes it out of you. Why do you think, you know, boxers, professional boxers look like they could, you know, break rocks on their abs and their shoulders? It's a tough thing to do. So, you know, even just in sort of basic day-to-day life, man, we got to be fit. We got to take better care of ourselves. After that is training. You know, you hear it all the time from anyone who talks about preparedness and self-sufficiency. Skills are more important than stuff. So what training do you have to defend yourself? How often do you practice your skills? You know, there's schools all over the place. Near me, there's a really great company that offers training. It's called Insights Training, and they train military, they train police, I think they train EMS in some ways. The two guys that are the main guy that started it and one of his main instructors are both ex-special forces, spent time overseas training contractors, that sort of thing. They've been there, done that. They've got great cred, and they offer awesome courses. And to be honest with you, they're fun, man. You get to learn how to do some of the things that a guy like me who's grown up in the city and didn't join the military, you know, the things that you would never have the opportunity to learn. You know, I took a general defensive pistol class. And, you know, I've spent most of my entire life around guns, very comfortable with them. Walked into this two-day class feeling extremely comfortable with my handgun of choice, which is my Glock 19. Feeling like, you know, inside and out, comfortable with it, chewed it, whatever. And 2 days later, walked out realizing how unprepared I was to use that handgun in a defensive situation, how I didn't have any idea what I was doing, and walked out with a sense of, okay, at least now I have some basics and some things to practice, and still I'm unprepared, but at least I have a clue to what I should do. Took that 2 day class. I took a 3 day defensive rifle class, which was essentially, you know, based on self-defense, but with your AR-15 style rifle and from a home perspective. You know, the general defensive pistol was, really about being out in the round, you know, carrying your weapon, use of defensive, you know, using it in a defensive situation, being out and about, some of the laws, but mostly their system of drawing, aiming, firing, reloading, clearing jams. I mean, the things that most of these people that do things like this teach in some form or another. Was able to take a tactical first aid course, you know, providing wound care in a active shooter or maybe under fire situation. And, you know, the really cool thing about this course was the guy that taught it, again, another ex-special forces guy. This guy was an ex-special forces medic for I don't know how many years. And his deal was that, you know, the number of things that you're going to be able to impact in the field, in the street, are pretty minimal. There's, you know, without specialized equipment, without specialized training, there's only so much you can do. However, one of the most important things that you can do and change, and one of the number one reasons for fatality is bleeding from an extremity. And being able to know how to stop it, how to treat it, how to change that situation could mean the difference in life and death in a lot of situations, especially in a situation where people are shooting. You know, you're likely to have bullet wounds in arms and legs, chest, stomach, where you might be able to make a difference and slow some bleeding down. So the course really was extremity-based, but about critical wound care in those situations. It was really cool. It was a one-day-long class. You know, one more thing on that. Well, actually, it really goes to training. I just read a really interesting article about the LA airport shooting. And what the focus of the article was that I think there was one TSA agent that died. I think it was only one. And he was shot, I believe, in either the chest or the stomach early on in the situation. And I believe, as I understand it, the shooter was put down, I think, within minutes. However, due to the fact that no one knew that, you know, were there other shooters, was the area secure, you had people all over the place that had gone through security, that, you know, they basically ran through in a panic, and they're trying to lock the airport down. You know, because EMS and fire will not enter a situation until the all-clear whistle has been blown. This guy laid in place and basically bled to death for 30 plus minutes. Now, I don't think he bled to death actually in the airport lobby or in the airport terminal, but I think he died later because essentially loss of blood. He bled to death surrounded by police and SWAT who should have been able to apply a bandage, apply a dressing, to treat a critical bleeding wound, but didn't and couldn't. They're in the article I read, I think it was on ITS Tactical, ITS Tactical, the blog. It's like Imminent Threat Solutions blog or podcast. The article talked about a survey or some bit of data bit that the vast majority of LA police hadn't taken the first aid class. Were supposed to, but hadn't. And I don't know. There was might have been another note about them not even carrying their equipment with them. Their tourniquet. So here you got a TSA guy that had a wound that, as I understand it, should have been survivable, and surrounded by people who any one of them should have had the skill to take a knee and apply some first aid while his buddies are making sure that there are no other bad guys with guns, and yet he bled to death. That's unforgivable for a first responder to not have that training or know how to do it or have the peace of mind to take a knee and help someone bleeding. I understand, and I have never been a police officer. I've never been in the Army, never been in combat, so it's easy for me to sit back and criticize. And I understand that the number one sort of motto or ethos of combat medics is the best way to keep someone safe is overwhelming superior fire. Put the threat down and then heal them. Then take care of your wounded. Make sure there's no more shooting. But in this case, there was no shooting. They were doing a search of the building. They didn't know it was secure. They didn't know what could happen. But there were no one was under fire. So there's no reason that they shouldn't have been able to help this
training scenarios.
But the ones that I participate in, actually, each sort of course of fire is a scenario. You know, sometimes it's you're mowing the lawn and two guys, attack you, and it's a game. People are doing it for speed and for points. I don't care about my speed. I don't care how fast I am. I do it to practice. I practice my accuracy. I practice my technique. I practice good tactical awareness and movements. Where someone tries to, might try to game a situation to be that much faster, to score better, I'm more interested, am I using cover? Am I doing the right kind of things to make sure that I'm not going to end up a dead dude? So, training, fitness, practice. Beat that subject to death. I think that's all for today. Again, this is episode 4 of the Urban Prepping Podcast, the podcast for living a more prepared and self-sufficient lifestyle in the urban context. I really appreciate you taking the time to listen today. As always, if you have feedback, I can be reached at loneurbanprepper@gmail.com. And please, please, please leave a review, good, bad, or ugly, on iTunes. Thank you very much, and have a great day.